and they want to have one. Well, what does it take to establish service? If you want to have daily service, if you drop down to the light tan, second light tan, the fourth item from the bottom, it says annual volume required for daily service. If you want to establish truck service, daily service between point A and point B, all you have to do is have one truckload a day per year, 365 days a year. If you want to add a second OD pair or a second destination pair, then all you need to do is have one truckload of that, double that number, and be able to go to the second one. When you start talking about an intermodal train, you need to have 91,250 units. So if you look back up there and you see where you say 150 to 400 truckloads, that's 150 containers to roughly on the order of about 280 containers on one train. So in order to do just one pair, one OD pair, to operate as a unit train model with intermodal, you have to have 91,000 units moving between those two points. This is one of the key factors that drives the size and scale of the facilities, and one reason why railroads are not particularly interested in going to very small places with intermodal facilities. It's very difficult to get this kind of volume. Ocean, 1 million units. Air, anywhere from 2,000 to 100,000 units a year. If you look at transit times, just going back to that very briefly, this issue about slowness, basically truck and rail, where you have a single driver on trucks and you're dealing with intermodal rail, you basically are moving about the same distance every day, roughly 500 miles a day. The truck driver is limited to 10 hours a day. The train operates 24 hours a day. The trains are operating at less than half of the average speed of the truck, but because it operates 24 hours a day, obviously it covers a lot more distance and so is able to basically compete heads up with the single driver. In terms of route infrastructure, the highway system for the trucks, the ports require the ocean and port facilities, airports. The rail is privately owned rail network in the United States. It is almost exclusively owned and developed and paid for by the private sector. Generally, we don't have a lot of flexibility. One issue that concerns a railroad and the issue of around reliability is it's not like an electrical system where if a substation gets knocked out, the electron travels at the speed of light and it can come from another location back into that point and go thousands of miles in a matter of milliseconds and make no difference. We're operating at 21 miles an hour. If you disrupt our system, you have 100 trains on that, they can't back up and easily go another direction. So you're very limited. Truck, you can always reroute it. Planes, generally, is virtually unlimited, or at least highly flexible within the air corridors. All the other forms of transportation are scalable. The trains really aren't. It basically costs you $300,000 to start a crew start a year. And it costs you that $300,000 if you were pulling one unit or you were pulling 250 units. So it's really not very scalable. What drives volume and density? Obviously, it's population demand. Back in 2005 and 2006, Virginia Tech did a study for the Department of Commerce, for the Census Department Bureau, and they identified over the next 50 years major megapolitan demand centers that would be growing in the United States. Why these areas highlighted on this map are important is that 60 to 70% of the population growth in the United States over the next 50 years is going to occur in these regions. For us, we use this as a major organizing principle for trying to understand how our network should be rationalized or expanded or developed in order to be able to respond to that demand. If you look at where we're distributed in terms of intermodal facilities, BNSF Railway has 32,000 miles of track. We serve the 28 western states, 3 provinces in Canada, and we interchange traffic into Mexico. So we're basically, as you can see, west of the Mississippi River. However, we do get into Atlanta, and we do get in through interchanges with the Eastern Railroads and into a number of other locations throughout the eastern United States. This shows the distribution of where our intermodal facilities are, and you can see that the intermodal facilities are very much related to the red dots that we see on here, which are actually the ocean ports that we serve directly in the United States today in North America. at our core rail routes, you'll see that it's relatively complex. However, most of the traffic that is moving in intermodal movements is basically moving from the ports of Seattle, Portland, and Tacoma into Chicago, or it's moving from L.A., Long Beach, into Chicago, or into Alliance, Texas, or down into Atlanta. Basically, it's a four corners kind of thing where you have a corner in the Pacific Northwest, you have the L.A. Basin, and then you have Chicago, and for us, Texas, it's a primary location for the major nodes that are connected in our system. And that was our overall core rail network. That included all of the carload activity that you would see. It also included the coal and the agriculture, which are the other two major, three major components of our system. If you look at our intermodal system, you will see it is much simpler. It connects with 10 out of the 14 megapolitans that are shown on this map. It clearly is not everywhere, all things to all people. It is focused primarily on these major metropolitan areas and the megapolitan growth centers that we see over the next 30 years. This shows market coverage. So we talked about proximity to each other. Basically, this for us, we look at a 200 to a 250-mile radius. When traffic comes into an intermodal facility, it's lifted off of the rail car. It's either stacked on the site, or it immediately goes onto a chassis, or if it's a trailer, it goes onto the ground. There's about 15, 20-hour period in which the dray company needs to come in, pick that up, and deliver it. And so they're able to deliver very effectively within a 200-mile radius, basically get one or two turns a day on most of the equipment out there, which is highly efficient. And so you can see there's relatively little overlap here. We've designed this system so that we can cover the maximum amount of markets in the country with the minimum amount of facilities. BNSF Railway is a railway combined company. It was previously the Burlington Northern and the Santa Fe. Merged about 15 years ago, and at the time of the merger, the two combined railroads had about 149 intermodal facilities between them. Today we have a little over 30. We've rationalized this system. These are major ones that we closed over the past decade and a half, almost two decades now. We're approaching that point. So we've actually rationalized this system significantly to improve the efficiency of the network. This is a map showing the requests that we have on a fairly regular basis over the last 5 or 6 years for new facilities to be opened. If you backed up and looked at, I should have put both of them on the same slide, you would see that many of the ones that were requested to be opened are very close to or within the radius that we already serve, or they're in locations where we previously closed a facility. I'd like to draw your attention to one particular case here. It gives you an example of what involved with trying to site one of these facilities. We had facilities at St. Paul, Dilworth, and Billings. Dilworth, Minnesota is right across the line from Fargo, for those of you like me from south of the Mason-Dixon line are not familiar with that territory up there. The Dilworth was primarily a facility that served UPS and the package business and the less-than-truckload business. It was a domestic facility. St. Paul is a very large international and domestic facility. Billings really functions as a location where we combine some intermodal flats or and equipment with the regular carload, and then move it to a point to where we can join it with the rest of the traffic. Bismarck, we didn't have anything. Minot, we didn't have anything. We were requested by the state of North Dakota we had a request from Bismarck to open a facility for Minot and Dilworth. They actually wanted one at Fargo, even though it's only 12 miles to the one at Dilworth. We came in, looked at the market, talked with the state, and basically asked the state to do a freight mobility study, which they undertook, and to decide where they really wanted to concentrate their efforts, because we knew we could not support this many facilities at that particular location. In fact, Dilworth was less than 50,000 and was in some consideration of being closed at that time anyway, because of the number of lifts that, or the number of units that we were handling there. We came in, took a look at it. As you can see, Bismarck is only 437 miles from St. Paul. Dilworth is only 240. Minot was only 273 miles from Dilworth. Billings was relatively close to Bismarck. So we came in, we knew we couldn't support all these. Of all the ones that we've had requests on that previous page, the only two in the U.S. that we have opened that are smaller facilities in the past 5 years were Minot and Lubbock, Texas. And Lubbock, Texas could support it because it had a specialized product, large amounts of cotton that needed to move in containers to the West Coast. After we did this study, we determined that we would close Dilworth as an intermodal center, and we would open Minot. We opened Minot, removed some of the activity that we had from Billings to Bismarck, and we permitted some intermodal traffic to move in the manifest system from Bismarck. So we basically rationalized the system down to these two locations. Minot, the justification for Minot was really twofold. Number one, they have some specialty grain products that do not yield themselves to large bulk rail car shipments. They lend themselves best to being bagged or being put into super sacks and going into containers. So they had a large amount of that activity. Secondly, they were willing to sign a guarantee. In other words, a take or pay contract. If we run trains in there, they pay whether it's full or it's not full. So that was the second thing. So it offset some of the risk that was associated with running trains in, dedicated trains into Minot. Thirdly, they were able to get a contract with the steamship companies. The steamship companies control international containers. The railroad does not. We don't own any. They were able to get a contract with one of the steamship companies that guaranteed them the availability of international boxes so that they would be able to have the containers there when they needed them and be able to fulfill their requirements. So this was a somewhat unique situation. Lubbock and Minot, in both cases, are generating traffic, a significant amount of traffic for export that actually justifies the development of a intermodal operation in a small location. I'll take a few minutes and I'll just take you through the other railroads. This is the Western network for the Union Pacific Railroad, who's our principal competitor. As you can see, their network is a little bit more dense than ours is. They do have a little bit more of overlap, but you'll see that generally speaking, it's very similar. Obviously, their lines run a little bit different, parallel to ours, but not in exactly the same areas. They have a very effective and efficient system. Heads up in just about every arena. They, as we are, have standards that you need to have about 200,000 lifts. A lift is a movement onto or off of a rail car, a container, or a trailer. You have to have about 200,000 in order to open a facility and be assured that it's going to be successful. But the situation with the Eastern roads is a little bit different. This is the CSX system. Again, a fairly rational system, but if you will notice in the lower right-hand corner, it says about 100 miles. So if you had a 200-mile radius around their system, they would look like they were all on top of each other. But in the east, you can actually get away with a shorter length of haul, and you can also get away with a more dense system because you have the population density in the area. So you're able to support these systems because you can get the volume at a local level and the density that makes it work. So it works very well for them. The other factor that affects it, especially in that northeastern corridor, and you'll see that even more so when we look at the next one, which is the Norfolk Southern, you'll see it's extremely dense in this area. Can everyone see my cursor? Hope so. Extremely dense in this area, the Norfolk Southern.
Van, to make everybody see your cursor, you actually need to click on the top of the screen. There's a top right, there's a diagonal pointing thick arrow. If you click on that and hold your mouse down, your mouse will turn into a, there you go, a green arrow, and just continue to hold the mouse button around and as you drag it.
So if you'll, thank you. So you'll see in this area, it's extremely dense. One thing you realize, for those of you that are in the Northeast, is not only do you have a highly dense population, but you have an extremely congested highway system. So to the extent that the highway system is congested, you need to have more locations. You need to be able to move. In order to get the turns a day and on the trucking end of it and make trucks successful, the more turns a day, the more times they can use that truck, the better off they are, the more cost-effective it is. If it costs you $700 a day to pull out of the lot, it's a whole lot better if you can deliver five loads a day than if you, you can only deliver one every 2 or 3 days. So clearly, that congestion, highway congestion, works to make the rail more competitive in shorter distances. It also allows you to locate your intermodal facilities much closer together than you would, say, coming from the western United States. Our average length of haul on intermodal is over 2,000 miles. The average length of haul of intermodal in the eastern United States is around a little less than 700 miles. So it's a much shorter length of haul. And again, because of the population density, I had the experience a few years ago not being very familiar with that part of the world and visiting Philadelphia on the 4th of July weekend. I was interested in seeing Gettysburg, and I thought I would drive over there one day and come back. At the end of that day, I had about a half an hour at Gettysburg because no one told me that there were 50-mile-an-hour interstates. So trucks moving at that kind of speed with that kind of density, it's very advantageous and it's cost-effective for them to be able to locate them with a much denser network. So kind of wrap this up, what are the consequences of locating a facility improperly? Well, one thing it does is it complicates the train makeup and the dismantling process. To the extent possible, a Class 1 railroad is a long-distance hauler. What we want to do is to be able to move a train intact as far as we can from its origin to its destination with a minimum number of intermediate stops necessary to fuel and do crew changes. If you have a train that has an intermodal train that has freight on it that has to go to multiple locations, then you have to stop and you have to swap blocks of cars that are going to go to these locations and be able to make a train up that will meet those requirements. So to the extent that you can simplify the system, it's what makes it work for UPS, for FedEx, for Hunt, and all the trucking companies that ship on us, all of the various retailers that ship on us. To the extent that you can simplify it, that you've got density and volume, it simplifies the train operations, it reduces the number of set outs. A set out is when you stop, take a portion of a train, set that out, somebody comes and does something with it locally, it reduces the number of pickups. Clearly, the more complexity you have adds time to the overall transit. The reason intermodal is so successful today and has grown as a major part of the business over the last 20, 25 years is because that freight can compete with truck and with long-haul freight being hauled by truck. One thing a lot of people don't realize, the vast majority of the UPS freight, ground freight that moves more than 300 miles moves on the railroad. Those trailers go on, they go to unit trains, and they move across the United States. You can go from Chicago to L.A. and easily under 4 days with these expedited trains. It increases the variability of service, more complexity, it's less reliable. One of the biggest complaints about rail historically has been, I can't depend on them. I can't get it when I need it. So facility operating costs, train operating costs, these go up. It makes it much more difficult to make effective investments in infrastructure. An intermodal facility such as we're building at Kansas City today is a $250 to $300 million investment. The trains alone are over $100 million. These are major facilities. So to build a minor facility, and unless you have the economies of scale to support it, that's a real issue. If you look at the major intermodal corridors in the U.S. today, you can see this outlines the system. In the east, you have the greater density, again, and you see City NS and the CSX corridors that they're working on today. Major part of these corridor efforts that the CSX and the NS are doing, the Crescent and the Heartland, these are designed to increase the track infrastructure, to remove obstacles to being able to double stack the containers, and to be able to move them as fast as they can, as far as they can, in a manner similar to the way the Western roads operate. And the largest in the U.S., probably the largest two corridors are the Sunset Corridor that you see on the south of the UP and our Southern Transcon, followed by the Central Corridor and the Northern Transcon. These are the really large routes that carry the bulk, probably carry about 70% of all intermodal traffic in the United States that's moving more than 1,000 miles is moving on those four corridors. So what are the characteristics of intermodal routes? Well, they connect major markets, they connect major ports, they're high capacity, they have the signaling and sidings and grade separations and primarily double and triple track main track that allows them to pass each other. We have about 100 trains a day going back and forth between between LA, Long Beach, and Chicago every day. We have about 50, 60 coal trains a day coming out of the Powder River Basin on the coal route. These are similar kinds of numbers that the UP would have as well. It's extremely important that we have the right kind of infrastructure to be able to pass, beat pass in the proper way. You want to minimize the route options, the more density and less complex, again, to get the benefits I talked about a minute ago. And then minimize gateways. What is a gateway? Gateways, the ports are gateways, and the interchanges between the railroads, between the Class 1 railroads, so that we interchange, for example, with going to the east primarily in Chicago with NS and CSX, to a lesser extent with CN and Canadian Pacific. We interchange in the Kansas City area with the Kansas City Southern. These gateways, minimizing the numbers of those that you are utilizing so that this you get that density and you get those volumes that makes it work efficiently, and you're able to assure your customer that they're going to have their products when they need them, their freight when they need them, how they need them, and at a cost that's competitive with truck. Just very quickly, move to ocean container shipping routes. These are the major container shipping routes in the United States. Clearly, the 600-pound gorilla is China. It's the interconnection between the West Coast ports. As you can see, these lines that take us across the United States, these are the lines I was talking about. Product comes into the West Coast, is moved across the country. Certain amount of transshipment work, particularly in the LA Long Beach Inland Empire area, some transshipment work that goes on in that area. Probably a third of what comes into the LA Long Beach area goes into the Inland Empire area and is then transloaded into domestic containers, which are 53-foot containers. It moves out as domestic freight out of there, again, all across the United States. So another third of it stays in the region, and about a third of it bypasses that area and goes directly on rail right out of LA Long Beach to the rest of the country. A lot of people have questions about the impact of the Panama Canal. We'll just have to wait and see. I'm not sure exactly what's going to happen. I don't know what the effect is. As you add 6 to 10 days, that's going to significantly, with slow steaming, is going to significantly increase the amount of freight that will be in transit. That's going to affect the inventory capabilities of these companies and their ability to get them when they need it. So they have to do a lot of different kinds of planning in order to do that. But there's no question in my mind that it's certainly going to be a boon to some extent, particularly the Savannah and Charleston, to a lesser extent to Norfolk and New York. A lot of discussion about Houston as a source of intermodal freight. The world is round, and sometimes we forget distances. If you will notice on this route, Houston is as far away, basically as far away from the Panama Canal as Savannah and Charleston. And from an intermodal standpoint, if you come to Houston, then you still dominates in the United States, the bulk commodities, right behind New Orleans. So I would think Houston has a lot of opportunities, but it's going to be in the bulk area, not in the containerized freight area. Just looking at capacities and gateway capability, the big boys are clearly on the East Coast today, and New York, of course. These large ships, the post-Panamax ships, were of the 8,000 to now 14,000, 15,000 TEUs is a 20-foot container equivalent. 20s and 40s are the international units. 53-foot containers are the domestic. L.A. Long Beach is basically L.A. Long Beach and that immediate area pretty much matches the freight of, if you took out New York, all the rest of them combined, you have that freight coming in through L.A. Long Beach. They have the depth for the very large, they have the depth of channel for the very large ships. There's a lot of work going on the east and a lot of discussions about that. One of the issues you have to consider is that I've seen numbers that range from $2 billion to $6 billion to be able to accommodate the largest ships of investment that would be required to be dredging of channels and being able to have the ability to support those on the east coast, those largest intermodal ships. So we'll see. It'll be interesting to see what happens with that. It definitely is going to be a benefit. Whether or not it's going to be a sea change, that's a matter of debate. Certainly a lot of people are talking that way. One thing you have to consider is at the end of the day, it's all about time and dollars. And if you put a pin in Detroit and put a pin in New Orleans and draw a line, that's kind of 250 miles on each side of that's kind of the demarcation line for freight coming into the west or the eastern ports. And that line moves according to the cost of transit and freight. So the railroads have a certain amount of control, I guess you could say, and influence might be a better word, influence over which way that freight will go, and we'll see how that works in the future.
Van, if I can just cut in, we need to start wrapping up in the next minute or two.
Okay.
Thank you.
Very quickly. These are the local port markets. Pretty much a large amount of product comes into these, stays in the immediate area. There's not a lot of movement in this. It moves within 100, 150 miles, and clearly that's a large part of the port business throughout the U.S. today. If we look at inland port markets that we see, again, bringing international freight into or out of these markets, they're very much centered on the megapolitans that we discussed earlier, and these are the areas that we do serve today, and you can see some emerging. Certainly Columbus is a very important one for the Norfolk Southern. We've seen it emerge as an important opportunity. So finally, freight density, the local market, proximity and market coverage, connectivity to core rail routes or inland ports, these are the things that are important for the ports, common use facilities, and of course we talked about the depth of channel and infrastructure restrictions that they have. These are all the factors that affect the ability of a ocean port to be successful. In conclusion, airports, air travel, ocean travel, rail travel, freight density is absolutely the key factor. How much freight you have, what the volume is, whether or not it's balanced, are you loaded both directions, or are you empty one direction? The intermodal facilities, clearly the inland and the port facilities are key to driving freight density, so where we locate those is absolutely critical also to the success of them. High capacity routes, minimization, simplification, try to keep this thing down to something that will move large amounts of traffic, longer distance, and be reliable for the customer and also profitable for the railroad, profitable for the transportation companies. For those of you that are transportation professionals, and I look at the list, there's a few on the list, I think we need to do a much better job of educating the public and politicians, our legislators, shippers on how transportation networks work. Certainly think we need a national freight policy, a national freight mobility policy to understand and planning, to understand how these networks work and how communities fit into it. We need to better define the future transportation network as we look forward. A lot of planning needs to be done. And then on federal, state, and highway highway transportation money, a recognition that highways and rail and airports and ports all have to be a part of an integrated system. And as if we want to have a national freight system or statewide freight system, then we have to have policies and use our money in a way that will allow us to maximize the benefit of that. Thank you, Jennifer.
Well, thank you, Van. I'll just check in again. Has John Morris joined in?
I still don't have them on the line.
All right, thank you. Well, then we will continue with our next presentation given by Chris Steele of CWS Consulting Group. So, Chris, you can go ahead.
Thank you very much, Jennifer. I really appreciate it. And thank you, everybody, for joining in this afternoon. What I'd like to do is share with you, kind of building off of some of the concepts that Van has put in front of us, certainly from the carrier point of view, a little bit more as to the existing point of view from the public sector as well as from the actual users of freight facilities, how they're looking at this game and how they're making location decisions. A lot of what you're about to see comes from a research project that we did for the Transportation Research Board and is now available as NCFRP, or National Cooperative Freight Program, report number 13. And if you're trichodescophobes, as am I, that should be a fairly easy number for you to remember. The work was done over the period of a little bit more than a year. We headed up the project along with Resource Systems Group, Fitzgerald Halliday, Hal Crow, and HDR. And what you're about to see in part has everything to do with kind of how this was then put forth into a guide for the public sector to help them to better understand the framework, the geography, how these companies were making location decisions, and then what they could do better to become better partners as well as to maximize their own opportunity. Just real quick, the reason that that we headed this up, a little bit about our firm, CWS Consulting Group. We're known here in North America as CWS Consulting, and outside of the North America, we're known as Investment Consulting Associates. We help companies make location decisions on an everyday basis and have been for a couple of decades now. It is our job, really, to spend time with our clients to understand the business pressures that they are facing and then to help them find the communities that can help house them. So in terms of what this did for the research on freight facilities, what I'll do is I'll give you a little bit on freight movement basics, at least as we then explained it back to the public sector, how the selection process works for freight facilities, a little bit about the public sector role and how that might be optimized, particularly in the form of best practices and lessons learned. And then what I'll do is I'll give you a little bit of direction as to how to find the NCFRP report documents, both the guidebook that we produced as well as the report of the supporting documentation, all of the analysis that we did. And again, just so that you know how this was developed, we spent a considerable amount of time talking to both the really anybody that's carrying freight in terms of warehouse operators, in terms of 3PLs, as well as manufacturers, retail companies, everything on that side of the private sector equation that could be considered a freight company. And then we also spent quite a bit of time speaking with the public sector to understand a little bit about what their current level of awareness was, where maybe some of the holes were, and really use that to turn something into a little bit better of an understanding, a little bit of guidance so that they could better understand. So the first part, of course, was to explain what we meant by a freight facility, and that required a little bit of a step backwards to explain what freight is in the first place. So again, logistics is basically just the movement of goods and people and supplies from one place to the other. And a freight facility is, of course, the point on the map where that stuff is stopped for a moment to either resort it, to store it for a period of time, to add value to it, or to bring it to a point where it's going to be brought to the end point of its consumption. So in simple English, freight facilities are the transition points in the supply chain. And of course, to underline why this is important, why public sector needs to understand what these things are, what they do, and where they go, and why, it's important to also remember that freight is the lifeblood of the American economy. You know, the ability to walk down to the store and be able to buy something off the shelf means that it has to be produced somewhere and then be brought back to that shelf such that we can purchase it. So this impacts things like domestic and international trade, the access to raw materials, all sorts of finished goods, and of course consumer goods. In terms of putting this into numbers, over 60 million tons of freight moves through the U.S. freight transportation system, and this represents about $40 billion in terms of goods. share of the gross domestic product. And then, of course, the processing of freight and intermediate processing, something that's going to play very importantly to economic development professionals, represents a real opportunity in terms of jobs and investment. And, of course, the efficient movement of freight lowers costs, allows for the best use of the transportation facilities across the different uses, that includes both freight as well as passenger, protects the environment, and reduces our energy requirements. And that has a variety of implications. Now, as we started to look into a little bit what the current state of affairs was, both in terms of the public understanding as well as, if you will, the private sector's thoughts as to what the public understanding is, a couple of themes came through. There was a lack of regional cohesiveness, that as you move from community to community, and especially as you start to cross state lines, there's a lack of regional cohesiveness. The actions at one local level may have applications and implications for other areas around the country, and that often those conversations don't take place. There's an incomplete understanding of how freight facilities work, as well as their role in the economy. So therefore, that has all kinds of economic development implications. There could be misunderstandings of individual communities and regions' roles in the community, in the global, regional, and local transportation network. That has all sorts of implications, both with regards to, as Van was pointing out, how you can determine whether a facility makes sense at a place, but it also has implications with regards to preparing for when freight is naturally going to want to move into an area because there's a large concentration of demand. There's a lack of coordination amongst planning, economic development, and transportation agencies, and that these agencies can tend to get siloed. And that they might not necessarily understand how their different activities might impact or have ramifications for other areas. And then, of course, lastly and very importantly, there's a lack of public and private coordination, which results then in a lack of understanding as to how the actions of one might impact the other. We did something of a survey followed by with some direct conversations with the public and the private sectors to see how they saw this picture. Interestingly, there was agreement both on the public and private sector side that the public side does not have an adequate understanding of freight operations or business drivers. They simply did not really understand how freight works and why certain changes would happen to that network. This has a variety of different ramifications, including some of the companies that we spoke with had dropped communities that did not plan for the transportation infrastructure or that their policies didn't adequately accommodate freight facilities. Companies also noted that they would recommend guidance in the form of inventories of things like sites, tax incentives, and of course the infrastructure that the public sector wanted to be used for freight. And then lastly, the folks on the public sector side, the community and the regional side, had encountered significant compatibility issues in siting freight logistics facilities. Now, compatibility issues is, you know, pretty much a euphemism for public hue and cry. So, if you can just kind of get that context. So, in short, the challenges and the opportunities for the public sector are, first of all, the public sector's building on the understanding so that there's a better appreciation of how freight facilities contribute to economic development of the area. And interestingly, that has implications both for freight-related uses as well as to the constellation of services that surround those kinds of activities. That it's important to understand the freight facility's role in intermodal connectivity and encouraging use of non-highway modes, or in other words, being able to build capability for non-freight uses so that it cuts down on some of that conflict. And speaking of conflict, being able to plan ahead so that placing, for example, industrial uses next to residential or public uses tends to be lessened over time. That there's an opportunity for better coordination amongst economic development, planning, and other officials at local, regional, and state levels. And of course, lastly, just to underline this one last time, a better understanding at the public sector level that the private sector is typically driving site selection for very distinct business reasons, but that participation early on to understand those pressures can allow for better awareness of the kinds of things that could be coming down, if you will pardon the expression, down the road at some point in the future. So, again, having to kind of go back to the public sector side again, it's useful to define what a freight facility is. I'm not going to go through in great detail for the folks that are here on the phone because I understand, or at least I would assume, that everybody has a pretty good appreciation as to what these different facilities are. I bring them them up here, of course, because each one of these is going to have a slightly different interaction with the transportation network, and is going to have a slightly different set of business drivers, which is going to then be manifest in how it chooses a location on the map. The location decisions behind each one of these, of course, is, as noted before, made by the private sector. And it's a network decision that is driven by fulfilling a business process need. The network is set up so that it optimizes a business driver in terms of serving a market franchise. If you think back to the maps that Van showed a couple moments ago with regards to the megapolitan areas, and then how, for example, the BNSF and some of its peers set up their logistics networks to solve these particular problems of moving from origin to destination, such that at the end of the day, the location process itself is an expression of that network strategy. Companies, as they go through the location process, will usually go through some form of the flowchart that you see in front of you here. It's a progressive and a narrowing, a winnowing process, where one starts with the universe of just about any location on the map and finally gets down to things that meet various and sundry business thresholds. It starts on the left by having a key understanding of the problem that this particular location or network of locations is to solve. It from there moves to a point with understanding what the must-haves are. What are the basic thresholds that we have to have in order to have success for this network or for this location? Once we understand that, we can carve off the bits of the world that don't actually meet those requirements, and we can move on to something else that allows us to do a location screening, where if we pick the things that we're allowed to do some trade-offs on, we can apply different weightings and start to see the different locations that consistently come to the top, and just as importantly, those locations that consistently come to the bottom. The ones that consistently come to the bottom, we no longer have to worry about. The ones that come to the top are the ones that we continue to look at to see if they will continue to perform as we apply other tests to them. At some point, we'll eventually go out into the field and start to validate whether what we have seen in the model, in fact, is presented by the reality on the ground, and then move into final negotiations and location selection. Another reason that it's important for the public sector to understand this process, of course, is that increasingly the left three boxes on this are done through data that's become readily available both to the private sector in the form of those companies themselves as well as the consultants that aid them. And as a result, the communities themselves have much less insight onto when they are under consideration for a new facility as things move forward. And they only start to get awareness in the very, very last stages. It's useful to know this, first of all, so that companies can get an so the communities can get an understanding as to if they start to meet the thresholds for things that they might be, under consideration for, they can plan for them better. Also, as one takes into account the economic development side of this, if one can understand those thresholds again, as well as to understand the things that they would want to get into that community, they can do a better job of preparing themselves and marketing themselves for the strengths that might be looked for in the left side of this equation. So what are the things that we would think of during a location screening? We typically are surveyed on a regular basis with regards to what is the most important thing with regards to locating a new facility, and unfortunately, it's not really a very useful question, because a successful location for a facility will meet a constellation of needs. That all having been said, if we talk about freight facilities in general, there are some things that tend to be looked at and have more importance than others. The top two at the top of this particular chart, the ability to access key markets or customers, as well as the ability to interact with the transportation network that moves between those markets and customers. Those are absolute must-haves. And that interaction with the transportation network really keys back to something that Van had said a little bit earlier in the hour here, with regards to it's not necessarily the same to be able to say that there is a rail facility or a highway that goes nearby. It's not as useful until someone can say, and by the way, we can provide you access to that rail network or highway. Labor and workforce, as well as the total cost environment, were also consistently noted by a lot of the companies that we spoke with. Being able to find the right workforce, the different levels of talent, because there is a whole spectrum of talent that might be required by anything from a distribution facility up through and including manufacturing, that it really still can be a very, very key consideration with regards to location strategy. Total cost environment, I believe, speaks for itself. And then the next group of these, the next six or so, factor for a particular kind of use, but it does suggest that their importance is a little less uniform across the spectrum. Here's a little bit of a chart that shows some of those same characteristics and how they move between the different kinds of facilities that we had described before: distribution facilities, intermodal facilities, and the various kinds of terminals. One thing I did want to point out, however, if you see the red box that's coming on there, those four, again, tend to be quite critical pretty much across the board. Slightly different kind of reactions, however, for the most part, they really do have to be very much in place to some degree or another in order to kind of push for success. It's also important to note, of course, is that anything that we talk about in logistics is by its nature something that is constantly changing. We only kind of scratched the surface so that we could pick up some of the major trends to advise the public sector, where, of course, most of our message was, if you stay in touch with the private sector, you'll have a much better handle on it. But while you're doing that, keep the following things in mind. There are global factors in terms of trade patterns, prices of oil and other fuels and energy across the board, as well as infrastructure and global facility adjustments that are constantly changing how things could shift. So paying attention to those is absolutely critical in order to be able to put together a strategy from the public sector that's going to work. It's also important to note that the different private sector companies are looking at different ways to make themselves more competitive, as well as address to other pressures that they are facing, just-in-time delivery, as well as, you know, trading that off against other things in terms of flexibility and resilience, sustainability over time, as well as their carbon footprint concerns. We are seeing some of our private sector clients that are paying more attention to this, and it certainly has implications with regards to other things as things move on. So this then comes back to the challenge for the public sector as to how do we maximize public benefit in terms of revenues and jobs, while at the same time managing other impacts to the community in terms of transportation and congestion, environmental cost, as well as controversy and other issues with regards to the relationship between the private and the public sector. Well, three main areas for action here. The first, of course, is pretty straightforward and should be obvious, but isn't necessarily always. And that is to learn more about the logistics field and the overall movement of goods. Understanding how the freight location drivers turn into a location requirement that could impact your community is going to really provide you with the best ability to plan effectively. Understanding the community outcomes, both positive and negative, in terms of real job growth or investment growth, as well as what the real impacts would be with regards to traffic, with regards to environmental impacts, can lead to better education of the public sector later on, as well as to higher quality decisions that really take into account not only the quality of the type of impact that we're talking about, but as well as their real, if you will, magnitude. And of course, this requires having the public sector ask questions of itself. Where does my community or my region lie within the freight network? What kinds of value trains are likely to cross it? What facility types and functions best match the location and the characteristics of my community? What strengths does my community or region have that give us a competitive edge, or might also be necessarily drawing facilities or networks through my area that I need to plan for? And of course, what are the benefits and the costs of having those facilities and those networks come through my community and my region? From there, it becomes the next challenge to communicate. Developing a regional and local dialogue on the role of freight planning and economic development is one where a lot of those same issues can actually come to the fore and be discussed in a very honest fashion. Educating and engaging the residents and the business community on the costs, benefits, and goals for freight development then allow for a much better discussion as to how one can determine which of those benefits are going to be fitting for that community, as well as which of the risks should be outright avoided and which ones should be mitigated. Then, of course, plan. By going through those initial stages of doing the understanding, the learning, as well as the conversations, one can understand the vision as well as the values a heck of a lot better. And through that, one can then put together a plan that ensures that the strongly held and understood vision for regional and local development can be turned into reality. It's important to make sure that economic development, land use, and transportation planning are coordinated appropriately. And of course, it also is important to once understand how all takes expression through effective zoning, regulatory, and incentive policies. However, I did want to kind of come back to another thing that Van had said before, and something that had become very, very obvious to us. Building it, they will come. Insisting that, for example, an intermodal facility would put in place as an economic development play is not necessarily going to be an effective strategy if it ignores a lot of the other factors that we've been talking about. The converse of this is also the case. Living up here in the Northeast Corridor that is very, very congested, trying to block freight from coming in when there is a strong need for it due to consumer and industrial patterns, trying to put the barriers up there is not necessarily going to make it go away. Being able to take a look at what the opportunities are as well as kind of what the pressures are is the best way to understand what one needs to plan for. As noted before, the report itself is available now. This is a view of the cover. It's NCFRP report number 13. It is readily available off of the Transportation Research Board's website. It allows for a much more in-depth conversation as to both the findings of the research itself as well as some of the implications for the public and private sector. Also available up on that in that same area is a link over to the original research report itself so that you can see much of the backup on this. And we have also set up, if you will, a new website that that really just discusses some of these issues as well as provides a very, very handy place for getting the information, freightlocation.org. And if you go there or over to the TRB site, you should have direct links over to the reports. Both reports, by the way, are available for no cost as a download. You can pay for prints through the TRB, which I think they would be very happy about. And Jennifer, that's it for me.
All right. Well, thank you, Chris. We'll try one more time. Has John Morris called in yet?
I'm still not showing the other speaker.
All right. Thank you. Well, if he doesn't call in the next few minutes, I apologize, everybody. We had hoped to have him present today. We do have his presentation available for download in the file share box in the bottom right corner of your screen, as well as the two NCFRP reports that Chris just mentioned and that John was going to be presenting about today. So at this point, what we'll do is go into our Q&A session. I do encourage you to continue typing in questions for the presenters if you do think of any additional questions. But let's see, since we just had Chris's presentation, we'll start with some questions for him while it's fresh in everybody's mind. So let's see, the first question is, key location criteria, are any of the companies you surveyed considering air quality impacts or community exposure concerns in selecting sites?
The way that they are starting to look at it is in terms of total carbon footprint. It's interesting in that it kind of varies whether we're talking about an American company or whether we're talking about one from, for example, either Canada or from Europe. American companies are starting to pay attention to air quality in terms of, if you will, a little bit kind of press relations and things of that nature, as well as really what the regulatory changes are meaning and therefore operational efficiency. Interestingly, however, European and Canadian and some other companies from some other locations have started to adopt some of these issues as being kind of core business issues. They've moved from being cultural issues to business issues, and they are using them as location requirements.
All right, thank you. The next question for you is, do you know of any examples of freight siting being well integrated into smart growth planning guidance?
Not directly. However, if you noticed, I didn't really go into any of the descriptions really of freight facilities. That would be an entire discussion in and of itself. But you'll notice the integrated logistics center concept that was there. That is also known some places in the U.S., particularly in the Northeast, as a freight village. And it's often referred to as kind of smart growth for freight. What it is a form of development that builds industrial capability at key nodal points on particularly the freight transportation network, usually incorporating both truck as well as heavy rail. And it's meant as a way, first of all, for kind of concentrating development in a particular area in a very strong smart growth kind of fashion, but also adopting a page from smart growth, really leveraging the transportation network to minimize minimize traffic impacts as well as emissions impacts.
All right, thank you. Next question. With your slide 13, isn't it fair to say that the location criteria listed at the top are important early on in the process when a company is selecting the right markets for a facility, and the factors on the bottom become more important when specific sites in a market are being evaluated and ultimately chosen?
That is certainly one way of looking at it. I would say that even, however, some of the things on the bottom, while the ones at the top tend to be exactly as the person asking the question put forth, you know, very, very much gating issues right up at the front, there can be some things down at the bottom that can become a gating issue. And I'll just use the example of an available facility of a given size and configuration, for example. There have been projects that we have worked on that, you know, while the network access and the market access are absolutely critical, at the same time, the company has had to move with such speed that having a facility in place or being able to get one out of the ground in a certain period of time in order to meet a business requirement for getting a product out to market has become a must-have rather than a like-to-have, and we can figure it out.
John Morris has joined the call.
Thank you. John, actually what we'll do is take a break from the questions now, and I will bring up John Morris's presentation. John, are you logged in as John 2 on the webinar?
Just with my first name.
Just John? All right. So what I'm going to do is promote you to presenter, and if you want to go ahead when you're ready, we'll jump back to your presentation, and then we'll get back to questions after that.
Yeah, great. Thank you very much. And this was on my calendar for a different time, so that is some administrative problem here. So I apologize to everyone for that. Assuming that I should move quickly through the presentation. So I'm with Cushman & Wakefield. We're a $2 billion global real estate services company, and we have within that company 120-person consulting team. It's a location and supply chain and labor and incentives group primarily. And we do a significant amount of international site selection. About half of our work is in North America. And we've done some of really the biggest site projects in the U.S. in the last few years. One that was significant and recent was the ThyssenKrupp steel mill. It's a mile-long processing steel line, and it's in Mobile, Alabama. That was a huge project in the southeast U.S. It had incentives packages between $1 and $2 billion being offered, huge capital project, and really indicative of the kind of project that teams like ours and teams like Chris's work on quite a bit. So I'm sure we talked quite a bit today about big trends in distribution and in manufacturing. Here's a quick list I've put together over the last couple of months. I'm not going to go through each of these, but I'm sure they're familiar with the group. Oil prices, inventory, nearshoring, meaning things going, you know, maybe to Mexico instead of China, or maybe to Kentucky instead of Mexico. E-commerce as a percent of sales, intermodal, larger space overall, and that's really significantly about the real estate market having the opportunity for people to upgrade. We'll talk a little bit about the Panama Canal, and really a growth in the markets for South America, which I think is a big deal for Southeast U.S. And our team's work really is focused around location strategy being the point of connectivity between distribution network requirements and real estate strategy. So here's a few I'd like to talk about now more quickly, and let's go into a few of them. So I'm sure Chris Steele has talked quite a bit about this, but really a location project is about the balance between operating costs and conditions. Operating conditions are things like labor supply, proximity to customer, utility, infrastructure and cost, transportation, infrastructure and equipment access. And then obviously any location project is about cost, people power, transportation, taxes, etc. But the interesting thing about any location project is fundamentally, and this is research from AMR, when a company makes that network decision around where to put their space, where to invest in capacity, they are effectively locking in 80% of their network. So that location decision sometimes isn't thought of as being this significant, but really when a company makes that decision, what they're really saying is we're realizing that we can only address 20% of our cost going forward. 80% will be really locked in from that decision. And the network study is a linear program, and it's a big math tool that optimizes multiple costs concurrently, and those costs are things that that vary as location varies, but also vary as volume varies. So you look at some of these cost curves, things that go down as number of facilities go up are things like freight, transfer freight, but almost every other cost increases as the number of facilities increases, such that there's an average cost curve, which for some companies is very finite, for some companies can be broad. In this example, as the price of transportation goes up, which is the representation of the dotted line rising, the number of facilities that their network should have goes effectively from 6 or 7 to 9 or 10. And what that means in terms of fuel, and looking here at the upper right for a moment, that's the EIA's publication of short-term energy costs. That's the U.S. diesel prices in this country. Many of us remember when diesel went to $4.85 a gallon in the summer of 2008 and how quickly thereafter it fell. And it's been on a similarly steady climb since then. In fact, if you look at the growth of the curve, the rate of the change of the price of fuel before the spike and after the spike, really they're growing at about the same rate. And what you see below is a network model picture. That's from an actual client. When we did a network study for them in 2005, when diesel was just over $2, our network model said they needed 4 mixing centers. When we look at that model again a couple years later, what we find is that immediately with fuel going up $2 a gallon, they immediately need 6 more DCs and in different and distinct places. So that's really the impact of fuel is now a company's network prefers space over freight. If you're in a real estate company, however, that's not necessarily bad news. So this chart is the relationship between the red bars, which are occupied warehouse inventory, millions of square feet, and the cost of a barrel of oil. And you can see there's a fairly direct relationship there between how the price of fuel grows and how the amount of space in this country is absorbed. So again, if you are within a real estate company and you're seeing that transition of the choice to use miles and freight, and the choice to use space, there is a distinct trade-off. And I think as the price of oil remains unstable, I think you'll see more and more companies choose space over freight. So quick trivia question for the group. Everyone raise their hand if they know the answer here. What is the percent of retail sales in this country that is e-commerce? Sometimes you ask this question and people guess 20, 25, 30%. This chart is a couple of years dated. This is from middle of 2010. But effectively, in this country, e-commerce represents about 5% of retail. But I think what's more compelling is the growth of that curve. And really, the volume of e-commerce doubles almost every other Christmas season. What that means, though, for a location strategy is something unique and distinct. For a traditional warehouse model, a standard store fulfillment warehouse, if you will, the two biggest priorities in where to put that DC are outbound freight and labor cost and supply. When you are talking, though, about an e-commerce facility where most of the orders are shipped parcel, small package, the location for that facility from a freight perspective becomes much less important than some other priorities. Now, this is an example from a clothing retailer that we worked with recently. Their first DC was in Columbus, Ohio. When they added their second DC to service the western half of the U.S., it is apparent shift in terms of amount of saving. It's significant. It's worthwhile. But where that DC wants to go, we modeled Phoenix, we modeled Los Angeles, we modeled Stockton, we modeled places like Lodi. The differences in freight costs between those locations that are far from each other is 1% to 2%. That's good news, however, because it now lets a retailer or shipper focus much more on other options under their control, other variables under their control, things like labor and incentives and the like. It really adds flexibility into a shipper's location priorities. An example of that is Target's facility in Tucson. Tucson, not normally thought as any kind of a distribution corridor, does have good inbound supply of rail. This was a facility that Target did a couple of years back. It is the 30th of 32 facilities in Target's network, and our recent meeting with them would indicate that of all of the facilities in Target's broad network, this e-commerce facility in Tucson is the number one performing facility in Target's entire network. On the first day to receive applications for 300 positions, they received 16,000 applications, and it's the top performing labor pool in their entire company. A couple moments quickly about the Panama Canal representation here of the third lock going in. And we all hear quite a bit about the Panama Canal and its impact. There was a tide of support for the idea that the Panama Canal would be a paradigm-changing event, and all of the freight going to L.A. Long Beach would now want to go to Savannah and Charleston and Norfolk. I think you're hearing a more rational take from people lately, which is that while the Panama Canal will be beneficial, it's probably more about the discretionary freight that may have wanted to go all water in the past that may now want to go all water in the future because of the lower cost per pound. We're seeing companies like Maersk develop some significantly sized vessels. Effectively, 5,100 TEU is the biggest ship that can go through the Panama Canal today. It will be close to 15,000 TEU in the future. It does require a bigger channel, a draft of 51 feet. But if you look at the size of that Emma Maersk vessel on the right-hand picture compared to an S-class vessel, which is a huge ship today, you can see the kind of scale impact we're talking about. And what all that means is a lower cost of freight for all shippers, and therefore, if the cost of all water traffic to Savannah goes down, you would think that the cost of land bridge traffic from L.A. Long Beach through Joliet, Chicago, would go down as well. It's interesting, though, if you look at the history of freight generally and what parts of the country in the U.S. it lands at, there has already been a gradual migration going on in this country. Effectively, port volumes are up all over the world, but if you look at the picture here from the last 10 years on the left, the share of freight has been changing, and Atlantic Coast share of total is down over the last 10 years. I think what the Panama Canal investment means is that share could stabilize or increase, but based on where people live and where merchandise comes from, significantly from Asia, this country already receives a significant amount of its import goods into the western ports. So let's keep moving here because I'm behind on time. In a recent survey from Area Development Magazine, labor cost, which has been consistently a concern for executives, ranked as the number two factor in site selection, number one in 2009. So clearly, labor matters. But labor is becoming more and more challenging to manage for clients these days. Multiple issues compounding here to really make companies rethink how and where talent is sourced. The aging of the workforce, the fact that it is an employee market, generational change, the kinds of jobs that younger people are training themselves for and want and expect today are different than 20 years ago. Urbanization, there's a gradual migration of population in this country away from rural and into urban areas, which isn't traditionally a fit for where plants and warehouses go. And then finally, the concept of the flat world. If people are really the strategic differentiator between companies, if knowledge is omnipresent and shared, the value of your labor becomes a bigger point of competitive differentiation than ever before. If you look at a couple of distribution labor markets, it's interesting to see some disparities here. So this is the Claritas Bay heat map, a dot density map, for the presence of distribution labor in two markets. On the left, you are seeing Chicagoland, and on the right, you are seeing Harrisburg, PA, which is obviously a big distribution market. If you look at that Harrisburg map, you will see a significant volume and density of target workers. If you look at the Chicago map, you'll see a significant density of target workers within a half hour of the city limits. But as you grow, as you go more rural and into the western suburbs of Chicago, that density becomes more scarce. So I think what that means in a place like Chicago is while the population moves closer to the city, and while your freight costs are lower closer to the city, and where that is where you can find a higher volume of target workers, the space and the real estate and the power and the incentives and everything else that determines location will be cheaper further out. If you look at Harrisburg, there's not many places to go wrong there from a labor perspective. Labor for 30 and 45 minutes is dense and deep, but the issue in Harrisburg is the saturation. Harrisburg is a distribution market where people change jobs for 25 cents, where sometimes workers are vanned in from 45 minutes away. So in either market, the point is there's a challenge. Finding the right labor, training the right labor, and keeping the right labor at a manageable cost. Here's a quick map of the density of labor around Chicago. And this is the density of target workers, the kind of workers that fit well in an industrial environment. Where the map is more red is where it's a higher density of target workers. Where the map is more blue or even purple is a lower density of target workers. And I think what you can see here is there's effectively almost a ring around Chicago about 100 miles out to where when you are inside of that ring, you're closer to population, your transportation costs are lower, but your density of target workers is also much lower. And that's the constant trade-off of in the Chicago market of where to put facilities. Another quick example, here's Atlanta, similar concept. There are very good beneficial industrial markets just south of the airport, but generally speaking, in the Atlanta area, to find a greater density of target-rich labor environments, you really have to be outside the city. So keeping moving here, just a quick comment on nearshoring, offshoring. The labor arbitrage opportunity to manufacture in China has been as high as 22-1 over the last 10 or so years. That gap, that arbitrage, if you will, has became about 10x in 2010, and it's forecast to be as low as 5x here in the near future by 2015. When you factor in inventory costs and transit costs, if the labor arbitrage, the labor delta is only a factor of 5, you're going to begin to see more manufacturing here in the U.S. And I think this is great news. It's a positive trend for the U.S., for all the U.S., for the Southeast U.S. in particular recently. Our group is active. actively engaged on 4 projects looking for manufacturing space in the Southeast U.S. By the way, I see here a question online about target worker. That's really more of a 10-minute topic, but what we mean by target worker is the right demographics and cost, attitude, aptitude, skills for a good fit in a manufacturing and distribution environment. So let's keep going here. Here's another key variable, particularly where the location is more flexible, is power cost. Power cost can vary by 100% within this country. This is a county level distillation of the U.S. EIA information on power cost, cents per kilowatt hour in the U.S. between 2008 and 2010. And where the graph is darker, where the map is darker, is where power costs are higher. And you can see in this case, we're mapping about 100% delta, so about 7 cents an hour where the map is very light pink, and about 14 cents where the map is dark red. No surprise at where some of the higher costs are, but maybe a surprise at some of the markets that are more rural where you might have thought power costs would be lower. Power costs are really driven by the delivery and by the cost of, and age of infrastructure. And I think as we go forward for site selection in this country, a power cost becomes a bigger point of distinction in site selection. Final topic I think for me is quickly on incentives. There's an interesting really bifurcation, I believe, in state fiscal environments today, where some states are becoming so fiscally and financially strapped, their ability to participate in business attraction competitive situations is becoming limited. There are also some states, though, where their business attraction budgets are growing, and I think you'll see that become more and more a point of competitive advantage in the future. This map here is the top 10 states from 2011 in terms of overall tax climate published by the Tax Foundation. And you can see the top 10 states, probably not very surprising, Nevada, Utah, Wyoming, South Dakota, Montana, Indiana, New Hampshire, maybe that one surprises me, and Florida and Alaska. And you would think that overall tax climate states would be those that would draw more economic development projects, but when you compare that to the top 10 states for number of projects in 2010, you can see that while incentives are part of business attraction, there aren't many states here other than Indiana that are on both lists. These are the top 10 states for business attraction projects. Texas was number one. There are a couple of strong states here in the Southeast U.S., Louisiana, Georgia, North Carolina, Virginia. And then a couple of Midwestern states, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. And then I think the message here is that while incentives are critical, it's things like proximity to population, availability of labor, and availability of beneficial space that are more important. So when you add together all the points we've talked about, and you're a company who's looking for space in Chicago, and let's say your warehouse space is represented by those ISO bars in terms of annual rental cost per square foot. If you're going to be close to population centers and be closer to the city, and you might be paying mid-4s in terms of dollar per square foot, you have an opportunity to maybe look further out where your rental cost, your cost of occupancy would be half that. So now you're a client, you're asking yourself, where should I go? And there are multiple factors that would drive a client either to be closer to the population centers or further away. Certainly fuel prices and the cost of emissions would make a company want to reduce its transportation miles, which would drive a company to be closer in. Requirements for service levels would make a company want to be closer to population. Cost of space, which we just indicated, would drive shippers further from markets. Things like hours of service, congestion pricing, tolls would drive clients closer in. Equipment restrictions, out here. We drive shippers further out, urbanization, drives capacity requirements further in. So multiple factors here, different for every client. And really, I think in today's environment, making every location decision just that much more difficult. So Jennifer, thanks. Again, apologize for the schedule concern. And hope I moved through that quickly enough.